On the Empire Podcast this week, we have more members of the crew of the Starship Enterprise than the actual Starship Enterprise, as Chris Pine, Zachary Quinto, Sophia Batella, John Cho, and Carl Urban join us for chats. All that, and the usual news and nonsense in the movie podcast that is aware that Sophia Batella's character in Star Trek Beyond is not a member of the Enterprise crew. Don't write in. Don't sue me. Please don't sue me. I have no money. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. After last week's interruption by Star Wars celebration, we're back, as regularly scheduled, with something of a Star Trek celebration. See, we're all inclusive here. We're fine.
It's a beautiful thing.
You know, as long as it has star in the title, we love it. It's all good. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up, as you just heard, is our geek queen, a lady whose favourite version of Star Trek is the Holodeck spin-off series. Did you know about this? Where two young ensigns, Sam and Dean, run around fighting demons and taking their shirts off. It's, of course, Star Trek Winchester. Hello, Helen O'Hara.
Hello. There was a fabulous news story this week that I'd just like to mention while we're on the subject of Star Trek Winchester, okay. which did a poll of Republican and Democrat voters' favorite TV shows.
Oh.
And the only one in the top three for both was Supernatural. Now, I'll be honest, the whole poll just didn't look very convincing, but I'm still taking it as a win. Supernatural has the power to bring a divided America together, and isn't that wonderful?
What was the Republicans' number one?
Supernatural.
That was number one?
Yeah.
What was the Democrats' number one?
Oh, I don't remember.
Was it Keeping Up with the Kardashians?
It wasn't, no.
Okay.
To their credit.
Okay. Why wasn't Deep Space Nine actually called Keeping Up with the Kardashians?
It's one of the great unanswered questions, Chris. It really is.
Mm.
I guess because they didn't want to keep up with them so much as they wanted to, you know, remove the ill effects of their many years of rule of Bajor and try and forge a new society.
Yes.
There we go. There's the second person, the second colleague of such lethal cunning. You just heard him making a welcome return to the pod booth after a long, long holiday going on some sort of art house trip of Europe. It's our art house guru. A man whose favourite Star Trek movie is, of course, Aguirre, Wrath of Khan. It's Phil Dissimulian. How are you?
Hi. It wasn't that long.
Thank you for that intro.
I'm
you gave me that joke.
A lot of shade for this holiday. It was only 2 weeks. That seems normal.
2 weeks? I don't think I've ever had a two-week holiday.
I spent a week of that stuck down François Truffaut Avenue in Brittany.
Which, just to be clear, is a road.
It's a real place. Yeah. I shall tweet it later. Uh-huh. I've been trying to think of a joke about what that road might be like for a week and a half now, and I've got nothing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, thanks. Welcome back. Wait, hold on. Welcome back! It's good to be back.
No one else has said it. So welcome back, Phil.
It's good to be back.
He had to say it himself.
Thanks.
Welcome back, Phil. I have a cold, by the way. I don't know how I managed to get a cold. I was on boiling 32 degree heat, and somehow I've managed to get a cold from that. Is that normal?
Did you go into an air-conditioned room at any point?
Yeah.
There you go.
Do you think that's it?
Yeah.
Also, the director had a cold, but we didn't kiss or anything.
Well, you say.
Yeah. I signed an NDA, Helen. What happens on the set of insert name of film here stays on the set of insert name of film here. So
well,
there you go.
I'm just saying I've now got an insight into how you get all those exclusives.
I know. Well, a gentleman never tells. But I tell you what, I'm very, very excited about insert name of film here. Looked really, really good. The sets were very, very good. The actors were particularly good. It's especially insert name of actor here as insert name of character here in insert name of film here. And that's enough of that.
How did you get Stephen Toast to voice over all of your embargoes? Incredible.
So yeah, I have a cold. So I may die at some point during this podcast, okay. But hopefully we'll be okay. Helen reacts to that with the... All right, so
he's resilient.
We have a question. This comes via email. I've cut it down massively. So it comes from someone called Ruse Fisser. I hope I've pronounced that right. I'm so sorry if I haven't. Anyway, there's a whole long email about how Jeff Goldblum makes a weird sound in Independence Day. In Jurassic Park, he makes that laugh, doesn't he? He goes, or something like that. So the gist of the question is, do you have a favourite movie moment where a movie character makes a weird sound?
Just a really good question.
I love this question. I have no good answers for it, but I love the question.
I have one good answer. Can I go first and get my one good answer out of the way? Because I think Phil has much better answers.
And Phil has an audio round. He's gonna have he's got like an AV presentation.
Yeah, preview of coming attractions there. My favourite is the sound that Loki makes after the Hulk has hulked him at the end of Avengers. It's just a little sort of... So, I think that's a very good song.
Do it again.
It's sort of a...
A whimper.
A whimper. It's a whimper. It's somewhere between a moan and a whimper. It's a
but not a sexual moan. It's a moan
no,
of someone who's in.
No, that would be wrong.
In, yeah, well, lucky. I mean, you never know.
Hey, whatever floats his boat.
Absolutely, who knows what happens? Well, it happens in Asgard stays. I've said that done again. but yeah, who knows what floats his boat?
Indeed.
Sexually speaking.
And let's not speculate, because I feel like that way lies a lot of confusion. And possibly angry Taylor Swift fans. So,
yes, perhaps. But that's a good noise. Phil Camp.
Yes, movie character makes a weird sound. Uh-huh. Hard to look past all of Dick Van Dyke's dialogue in Mary Poppins. Equally, Don Cheadle.
Do we understand what he's saying even to this day?
Choppy doo da doo da. Yeah, up the chimney. I think is one of his monologues, and there's a few. If you Google weird character noises, there's just an endless number of Matthew McConaughey supercuts. Now, I hadn't, until I watched one of them, hadn't realised that it is kind of a stock in trade for him, in the same way that Brad Pitt is always eating.
Yeah.
Matthew McConaughey has this thing where he just makes weird, presumably unscripted noises. I think the finest of which is probably Wolf of Wall Street
with the...
Yeah, with his whole like chest.
Chest bang.
Which is something he was doing in real life.
Yeah, between takes.
Beforehand, yeah.
Yeah, and basically Scorsese was like, that's interesting, do that.
Yeah, so maybe that's just the thing he does. That's maybe just a personal tick. A lot of love for Steve Carell's chest waxing scene in The 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Kelly Clarkson!
Yeah, Kelly Clarkson! As an impromptu kind of howl of pain. I do have an audio presentation to make. Ooh. Because I think my favourite is probably, it's the moment in The Three Amigos where they're breaking back into the studio, the three of them. And Steve Martin is on the wall and he's trying to attract the attention of Chevy Chase and Martin Short.
I know this one.
Without giving away the fact that he's actually a human being shouting for their attention. Have a listen to this. They're literally 15 feet below him throughout this entire thing, just sitting there obliviously.
That's amazing. How did you do that?
I don't know. It was magic. And you can't really have this without talking about Michael Winslow in Police Academy. Mm-hmm. Can you?
No, you can't.
No, you can't. Or indeed in Spaceballs also.
Or in Spaceballs. Or if you Google him, there's a YouTube clip of him performing the sound of 32 typewriters. He does the history of the typewriter in noises. Thanks. It's incredible.
That's amazing.
When he got to the iPad, it got complicated for him. But yeah.
That's a really good answer. I have to say, I love that Three Amigos clip. We used to use that in Empire, some of those signs, because there was one year we were covering the Oscars, and Empire being as organised as we are, we had a TV at one end of a long corridor and a computer that was capable of updating the website at the other end of the corridor. And so we were watching the Oscars one year in this setup, and I had to basically email the copy to Amar and then attract his attention to let him know that the copy was there so he could put it on the website. And we literally did start doing, waka, waka, look up here, to let him know that the email was in his inbox. Because obviously he was, you know, busy working and wasn't checking his email every 5 seconds.
Nice.
Yeah, it was
practical
pretty. Practical uses for odd noises made by characters in movies. There
ga-ga,
you go.
Ga-ga, Amma. Perfect.
And if Amar's listening, I'm sure that brings back wonderful memories. Hey.
I love Jack Nicholson as the Joker in Batman, where he goes... You know, he has that line. He goes, well, you know, he's reading the newspaper. And he goes, "Winged freak terrorizes. Wait till they get a load of me." And then he goes, "Oop, oop, oop," and then he just laughs maniacally. I always love that oop. In fact, I may say it in the office from time to time. There's tons. There's tons, but yeah, I think Phil's nailed it.
Have I?
I think you've nailed it, man. No,
that's good. That's saved us working harder.
You know, Clint Eastwood, any characters like that, who go like a little moan, or a Harvey Keitel, you know, the Harvey Keitel howl of anguish, which you probably hear if you're on the set with him on one of those direct line TV adverts just before the cameras start rolling.
Does it go?
As he rocks back and forth, trying to figure out what the hell happened. But you know, Reservoir Dogs, whenever he learns the truth at the end about a certain character. I don't want to give away spoilers, obviously, for this movie. It's only just come out. He's like... It's a bit like that, isn't it?
And then
he does the same noise in Bad Lieutenant when he's rocking back and forth in the nutty.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he's pleasuring himself by the side of the road. But, you know, but it's the Harvey Keitel scream of anguish.
I quite like the Al Pacino sort of just general exclamations.
Oh, hooah, 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 hooah.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
And all the sort of booyahs you get from Marines and such as well.
Yeah. That's a belter. Darth Vader makes a funny noise. Has anyone ever noticed that?
Yeah. No, I've never, nope. never, yeah. never
not
heard
picked that up.
No.
You ever noticed?
No.
You do not know the power of the dark side. Watch it again.
I'm going to be listening to that.
They may have taken it down for the special edition, in fairness.
I'll try and get the theatrical cut. Yeah.
It's true. It's true. Your lack of faith disturbs me. That's Pee Wee Herman, isn't it? Basically, that's just... Pee Wee Herman as Darth Vader would be amazing.
I think we've really smashed this question.
Mm. My apologies to Ruse Fizzer. If you think we've missed anything out, and of course we have, because there's approximately... How many movies have they made? I mean, how many movies do you think they've made?
Lots.
What, they?
They, yeah, them. You know, them.
Them in the world.
Yeah. How many movies?
I mean, 100,000? A few more?
100,000?
I don't know.
100,000 movies?
Well,
that's a lot of movies.
1,000 movies a year or 100 years?
That's a lot of movies. Yeah. So we're saying at least 100,000 movies. Probably more.
Probably more.
Probably more.
Yeah, because lots of the early ones, I mean, they were just, you know... racing out one a week. I mean, I don't know if we're counting surviving movies. Obviously, that's a different issue. And of course, you've got to take in Nollywood and Bollywood and all the rest.
Yeah. We literally have no idea.
We really don't. I wonder if anyone has counted it up. Please, if you know, let us know.
Yeah, please do. Because my point is, there's a lot of movies.
And that is correct, yes.
And there might be some out there we haven't seen. They've got incredible noises.
I don't think there are any we haven't seen, are there? I mean, there's some maybe you and I haven't seen, but certainly none that Phil
has. Phil picks up the slack for us.
I've seen about 67 movies.
67 movies.
Wow, that many.
Beat that.
Yeah. Oof. I've seen five.
No, come on, there are more.
There's
Marvel
been more
movies
Marvel
than
movies than
that.
This is true. This is true. There's been loads of Marvel movies. But so yeah, so the point is there's loads of noises. If I think of something during the rest of the podcast, I will say it. If you want to have your question read out in the Empire Podcast, do send them in to us. We're on Twitter as @EmpireMagazine. Use the hashtag EmpirePodcast. We're on Facebook as Empire Magazine, and you can email us podcast@empireonline.com. Right. Let's have some movie news.
Right, there's quite a few interesting stories this week, although there are no huge, huge, massive ones, I would say.
Nothing huge came from Celebration last week, because we recorded our podcast on Sunday morning, and then they had the Future of Star Wars panel, and nothing really interesting came from that,
No,
did it?
I mean, they confirmed Alden Ehrenreich as young Han Solo, but I think everybody in the world knew that was coming, so that was not a huge
revelation. I think he did.
I think he did. He actually mentioned, he did discuss it in the panel, not having been able to tell people, and people kept coming up to him and congratulating him over the last 2 months since the news broke, and he was sort of going, "You," and doing like finger guns back at them, but not saying anything because he wasn't able to say thank you because obviously it wasn't announceable.
People
yet.
Have been congratulating Chewbacca as well.
Well, yes. Well, who will be in?
Do you think those two have been hanging out, Alden Ehrenreich and Chewbacca? Each other.
Yeah, they've got to get that chemistry right, don't they? And yeah,
they do indeed.
He makes some weird noises, doesn't he?
Chewbacca,
Han Solo, Chewbacca. Yeah.
Never really noticed Han making a weird noise.
Chewie
makes weird noises. Yeah, although they're for him, they're not weird.
No, true.
Yeah, that's just sensible dialogue. Yeah, you're just racist.
You're being a Wookieist, yeah. Phil.
Anyway, there was news. Other news, other non-Star Wars news this week. The Divergent series. The last film didn't do so brilliantly. And they're now talking about finishing it off, not as a theatrical release, but as a TV movie, which would then allow most of the film cast to step away and then be replaced by a TV cast launching a TV series, which is a pretty radical lack of faith, frankly.
Is it called the Divergent series Vehicle Reversing? What is it called?
It would still be known as Ascendant, but it would be a TV movie they're talking about.
Just why bother?
Well, because, you know, people like the series, I guess. Somewhere.
Do they?
Somewhere
enough to make the film series increasingly
Yeah, the last film wasn't exactly great. But, I don't know, maybe the world might be able to work better as a TV show, frankly, than it did as a movie. The problem is always that it had far too much backstory and not enough actual story. So I feel like maybe that would...
Not enough front story.
Indeed. Mm. That would maybe be the place for it.
There seemed to be a lot of what young adult... franchise properties vying for young adult dollars about the time when the last one came out. There was the Hunger Games was still going. Maze Runner had just got started, I think.
Yeah.
And it was just so inferior to even the Hunger Games.
Yeah.
Big drop off. I think nearly 300 million for the second one, and the first one went up, and then it dropped by, like, I guess more than 100 million. So projecting that forward doesn't look very good for it. It's not a particularly great franchise.
No.
I didn't think at all.
Who knows? Maybe they're trendsetters and pioneers. And certainly we've had enough examples over the last few years of movies that have tried to become franchises and stopped because of lack of audience interest. Percy Jackson, Mortal Instruments, City of Bones, to name but two. Mm. So maybe the answer is to downsize and go on to TV, and maybe there you find the audience, and then who knows, in
Mortal
10 years' time.
Mortal Instruments already has, and they've discovered a even less exciting cast for TV. Anyway.
The difference with this, I guess, is that it was a going concern. You know, it was a franchise that you'd thought had been established. It's normally like, does the first film work, and then you make another one? It's rare that you'll have two, and then, you know, three, in fact, and then suddenly go, no one cares anymore. That's kind of bleak.
It is a
and I'm
bit
sure
tough.
It'll be used as an example of like how this whole young adult franchise filmmaking is grinding to a halt.
Yeah, and I think also it shows the failure of the... I think basically this is a bit of a referendum on, if you'll forgive the word, on the decision to split the last book in two. It's enough with that.
A divexit, if you will.
Yes. So it's enough of that. I think everyone is tired of that. It didn't do The Hunger Games any favours. It was really not going to do Divergent any favours. And I think, like, for example, The Maze Runner filmmakers will probably be taking a very, very close look at that as well. Speaking, though, of young adult stuff, there is slightly happier news this week, and that is the news that a We Free Men movie is coming from the Henson Company, working with Rihanna Pratchett. Now, the We Free Men is one of the Terry Pratchett books. It's set on the Discworld. It's sort of almost a spin-off of the main Discworld books, if you like. It has a slightly younger audience in mind. It has a teenage girl protagonist called Tiffany Aching, who is a young girl with a talent for witchcraft, and she basically sort of becomes a witch, essentially. But she is helped on her way by the titular We Free Men. They are the young, tiny, 6-inch high blue men of the clan Nac McFeagall. They have a particular way of talking. They are endlessly entertaining, and I am actually really quite excited about this. So it's being developed with Rihanna Pratchett, who is Terry Pratchett's daughter, as the name might have clued you in. She's a very successful game story writer in her own right, and she's kind of overseeing, I guess, the Pratchett legacy through her company Narrativia. So this, I think, is a really exciting prospect. I mean, the Henson Company would seem to be perfectly aligned with Pratchett's sense of humour and his sensibility, and I think it's a bit of a match made in heaven, so I'm actually really, really hyped for this one.
Hyped. Pratchett. I don't know the We Free Men, actually.
It honestly, great stories, and they are just hilarious little characters, so I'm quite excited to see what they do here. There's a lot of chance for kind of little side comedy moments, even in the middle of action scenes. And their scale and their ferocity are a wonderful kind of match. Like, basically, they should be the underdogs, but they never, ever see themselves as underdogs, ever. And will basically just march into battle against things, you know, 100 times their size. They will also sometimes be known to, for example, steal cows and sheep. But what they will do is literally just... three or four of them to a hoof will pick up the animal and just run away with them. So you'll see rather startled sheep apparently moving stationary but moving backwards at speed towards the Nac McFeagles sort of little mound home.
Actually, I think I may have met some of these people growing up in Northern Ireland.
Yes, in fairness. Yes, so they're very similar.
It sounds familiar. I think I went to school with a couple of them.
It should be a lot of fun. And it is also a sort of a mini franchise within the Discworld universe, so it actually does have the prospect of sequels and so on down the line if this one does well. But it isn't in no way but dependent on that, and we don't have to split the last book in two.
These are exciting times. Exciting times. Phil Cat.
Yeah, hi. Exciting news for me, because I'm actually reading the book at the moment, but The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt is going to be made into a movie, and it's directed by John Crowley, who you may know, obviously, from Brooklyn, but also Boy A, which was probably a good sort of calling card for this one, in the sense that it's about a kind of young, slightly troubled, would you say, kid who sort of, you meet him when he's 13, the Metropolitan Museum of Arts in New York. There's a terrorist attack which kills his mum, and then it kind of follows him through his life.
Yeah, that's the opener.
That's how it opens. That's not a spoiler. That is the first few pages. I'm currently reading this book at the moment. It's terrific. I'm on about page 400 and something.
So only 800 to go.
That's a big old book.
That's a slight exaggeration, but it is a very lengthy book.
Is it in big type? Because otherwise I might struggle.
No.
Can someone read it to me? Otherwise I might struggle.
Why don't you just wait for the film and the rest of us will read it?
Can someone then read the subtitles of the film to me?
Okay.
It feels like a lot of work.
It's kind of like a strange version of the Thomas Crown Affair, in the sense that when this terrorist attack, this bomb happens in the Met, the kid takes a Carol Fabritius painting off the wall in his sort of post-traumatic stress state of mind, and he keeps it through decades. And the painting plays an important part in the story. And I think it's going to be a challenge to adapt this one.
I would imagine it's such a sprawling, lengthy book, and it follows one character so kind of forensically closely through his childhood, adolescence, early adulthood, that it's a real challenge, this one, to adapt. You've got to have some seriously good, presumably, performances there. You've got to have two or three.
Yeah.
You've got to have two or three good actors for
you
that.
You do, because you follow him from, I think he's 13 when we meet him, and he grows up throughout the course of the book, so you can't use obviously the same actor, and strong support around him as well. I'll be honest, I thought that Donna Tartt's first novel, Secret History, was the most sort of filmic and cinematic, sort of set as a murder mystery with cultish overtones, set on a sort of Ivy League style campus. That seemed much more contained than this. This goes off to Las Vegas, it goes off in different directions, and it is sprawling.
It is.
So it'll be interesting to see, but I guess they've looked at John Crowley, not an American, but directed Brooklyn, so has a good strong sense of place and New York in particular, and directed Boy A, which, you know, had a Andrew Garfield as a kind of troubled, slightly troubled, rite of passage type protagonist. So I'm excited about this. I hope it gets enough money to really give it scale.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, obviously, Brooklyn is a good kind of calling card as well in terms of adapting a novel, a much easier one, I think, in that sense, and it was probably it was a fairly close adaptation, not in all respects, but it was, you know, reasonably close. Andrew Garfield might not be a bad shout for the adult version.
Yeah, I was thinking Donald Gleason
would be great. Yeah,
And he falls in with a guy, an older man called Hobie, who's an antiques restorer.
Yeah. Will Ferrell.
We think Will Ferrell for that. Well, failing that, maybe Stephen Fry.
I am perhaps slightly more up on Stephen Fry, but only marginally. Will Ferrell could do it.
He could do it.
But yeah, it's a fantastic, fantastic book. So if you haven't read it, highly recommended.
It is a fantastic book.
So yeah, fingers crossed for the movie.
This is great. Are there any superheroes in it?
Let's say yes, Chris.
Okay, I'm on board.
A little bit of other news. Some dates have been announced for 2019.
2019 one of the dates?
Yes, okay, I suppose it is.
They were good.
Anyway, Edgar Wright's Shadows will apparently be out that year, which is something he's apparently been working on with David Walliams, and it's a reworking of a project originally called Me and My Shadow, which was about a frustrated shadow that wanted to be free of his life with the world's most boring human. A guy called Stanley Grubb. So it's sort of, I don't know, we don't know what Edgar's done with that yet. He's obviously busy at the moment finishing Baby Driver, but that is apparently next on his plate. And also in animated news, Shrek Forever After, you might have thought was the fourth and final full-length feature Shrek outing. Apparently there will be a Shrek 5 by public demand. I don't know.
You know, every day when we come into this office, Helen, we have to fight our way through hundreds of Shrek fans who grab us and look us in the eye and go, when?
When?
Will there be another Shrek?
I mean, they haven't released any plot details yet, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say that it starts off with Shrek wanting to be alone and live like an ogre, and then realizing the value of family and friends. Because that's what happened in every single feature and short film about this character. So far.
You're very cynical.
I am.
You know, what would Shrek say when faced with such cynicism?
He'd say, I want to be alone. And then he'd realise that he doesn't really.
Ooh, get in my belly. Oh, that's a bad bastard. It's much the same. I like most of the Shrek movies. And it's easy to forget now how huge the first two in particular were.
They were. Yeah.
I mean, enormously huge. So I'm actually surprised it's taken them so long after Shrek Forever After to come up with a new one. The Shrek exhibition in London is perpetually popular. The Shrek musical, which starred, I believe, Barry from Four Lions as Shrek. True story, in fact.
Did
fans.
It?
Yeah.
Did it?
Yeah, he was the first Shrek in this country, anyway.
Wow. Anyway, I'm very cynical about the plots of these films. Yeah. I'm not saying I hate the films.
No, of course.
I've quite enjoyed them.
Yes.
But they have all ultimately been... Oh, I want to be on my own.
Yeah.
And then, oh no, I don't. I like my family, actually.
I liked Shrek's Forever After kind of It's a Wonderful Life treatment of the story. That was quite fun.
I mean,
that did something slightly different.
Did it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it started him on his own as well. So he didn't have the fallback of Fiona and the donkey and why do I know these character names? But why do I know the name of the donkey? What's the name of the donkey in Shrek? Yeah, we'll see how it goes.
Sure.
We'll see how it goes. Well done, Shrek. Well done. And well done... Is it still DreamWorks who are doing
it? Yeah, DreamWorks Animation.
Well done then for, you know, not letting it lie. I've got some news.
Yeah, what is that?
I've got some huge news, guys.
Come on then.
So the third horseman in Adam Sandler's four-picture Netflix deal is called Sandy Wexler, following hot on the heels, of course, of The Ridiculous Six and The Do-Over. But this one, I don't know, this one could be good. This one is a romantic comedy. He plays a talent manager. He has a group of eccentric clients, and then he falls in love with this newest client, who is a tremendously talented singer he discovers at an amusement park. He plays Sandy Wexler, of course. And the tremendously talented singer is played by a tremendously talented singer, Jennifer Hudson. Oscar winner, Jennifer Hudson.
Okay.
So, I like Adam Sandler in rom-com mode. I like Adam Sandler in most modes, but recently, as we've agreed on the podcast, he's gone off the rails spectacularly. But who knows?
Did anyone see The Do-Over?
I watched it.
What did you think? It looked okay.
It wasn't
okay, was it?
It wasn't awful.
It was
and weirdly enough,
awful.
It wasn't really an Adam Sandler movie. It was and it wasn't.
Yeah.
It was main.
It was
anyway,
just there.
The focus was on David Spade.
Yeah, right. It was kind of like Central Intelligence, but less funny.
Right.
Take from that what you will. But there,
like
yeah.
Central Intelligence.
Yes. And then this week as well. So last week we discussed there's some Star Trek 4 news. So they're preparing for that. The Star Trek Beyond opens this week on both sides of the Atlantic. So hopefully it'll do well enough to get a sequel. Because as you'll find out in a few minutes, we really liked the film. Damn it, spoiler! But last week, of course, there was the news that J.J. Abrams said that Chris Hemsworth was going to be in Star Trek 4. I keep calling it Star Trek 4. It's not. It's Star Trek 14.
Mm-hmm.
The next Star Trek movie, whatever it's going to be called. So he's going to be back as George Kirk, which is great because that role in many ways made him, put him on the radar, put him on the map, and sent him on the road to Thor, which is fantastic. Very, very excited about that. And this week, of course, J.J. Abrams continued to give out some news about the next Star Trek. He said that, obviously following the tragic death of Anton Yelchin recently, that they will not be recasting Chekhov for the next movie.
Yes, which is correct, I think.
Which is correct. They don't know what they're going to do yet, whether he's going to die off screen or whether he's going to boldly go off on his own adventures and maybe be acknowledged at the beginning of the movie. What do you think should happen? Personally, I would not like to see that character die in this timeline.
Yeah. I think they'll promote him out to an exciting new ship or something. I think that, you know, the way, and again, I don't want to get into spoilers for Star Trek Beyond, but they had a very classy in-story tribute to Leonard Nimoy in that film, and I think they would aim to do something similar for Yelchin. JJ's actual words were, there's no replacing him, there's no recasting, I can't possibly imagine that, and I think Anton deserves better. We knew going into this movie it would be a bit of a heartbreak just because of Leonard. We had no idea just how devastating things would become. So,
absolutely. And I think you're absolutely right. The very nature of Trek alone means he can get a command somewhere else, or a berth on another ship, or, you know, stay in a space station, or do anything. So yeah. I would like that character to remain alive within the Star Trek universe. I think that would be a very fitting tribute indeed. And of course, there's precedent for this, you know, keeping Paul Walker alive at the end of Fast and Furious 7. What an unexpectedly moving moment that was. So it'd be nice to see something like that for Chekhov and Anton Yelchin in the next Star Trek movie.
Definitely.
And there was also some sad news this week that the great Gary Marshall, best known in terms of film, I think, for directing the likes of Pretty Woman and Runaway Bride, and most recently, his most recent movie was Mother's Day, which came out about a month or so ago over here. But in TV, he was a comedy giant as well. He had his fingers in many pies, including Happy Days. Hell's bells.
Yeah, it's a very sad day, really, because I think he, you know, listen, his latest film was, I think we can all agree, not a very good one. But to be working to the end at that age is enormously impressive, and I think it speaks to the enormous affection in which he was held in Hollywood. I mean, I think you look at his kind of filmography and his work, and he seems like he was a fan as much as anything else. He seems like he genuinely just loved making movies, making TV shows. I saw him about a year ago in a Brooklyn Nine-Nine cameo where he played a robber, and no one could believe he was a robber because he looked so sweet and elderly, and, you know, everyone kind of treated him like their grandpa. But it was a really funny performance, and I think he just did it presumably because he was just a fan of the show or something, or a fan of some of the people involved. And you just got that sense from his work, because he was able to get, you know, even for something like Mother's Day, he was able to get huge stars, I think, because people just had affection for him. And I think that's, so just on a personal level, I think he's a great loss to many, many people in Hollywood. And then, you know, his work itself, I mean, great, great TV shows. You know, Happy Days was obviously a phenomenon in the 70s.
Which he created.
Mm. And then out of that, you know, came Mork and Mindy, Joni and Chachi, all these.
Vern and Shirley.
Vern and Shirley.
All the Ands.
And they were solid comedy premises. Premises. That work really well. I think he had a great eye for talent, you know. Obviously, Ron Howard went on to great things. Robin Williams, this was his first big role, really. And I think it helped launch him. Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman. She'd made films before, but, you know, that was the one that made her a star. There's no question about it. He made Beaches. He made Overboard. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
What a great movie. And The Princess Diaries, you know, say what you like for it. It's obviously got a younger focus, but Anne Hathaway was brilliant casting for that movie. Absolutely brilliant casting. So I just think he had a real, an eye for people, an eye for what worked. Yes, he told fairy tales. No, they're not sort of, you know, good art house gems that are going to change cinema. But as a maker of fairy tales, he was rarely surpassed.
He was a TV giant, wasn't he? Mm. I mean, I think he was responsible for around about 1,000 TV sitcom episodes.
Wow.
Which is phenomenal. But I think what shines through on all of the sort of fulsome tributes that have been paid to him this week is that he just really liked people and he liked characters. And one of his favourite sort of bits of direction for actors was just talk like a normal person. If you show them something of themselves, they'll love you for it. And that kind of comes across, you know, even in the films that didn't land in quite the same way. They're full of warmth and spirit.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, he's got a great filmography to revisit in coming weeks.
Yeah. I'm just remembering Chris Pine in Princess Diaries 2, Royal Engagement.
Hard to forget Chris Pine.
I mean, how could you? It was terrible hair. But it was one of his first leading roles, you know. So I think that, he really did have an eye.
Yeah, absolutely. Frankie and Johnny, there's an overlooked one from his filmography. Al Pacino and Michelle Pfeiffer. That's a good one. Overboard, you're absolutely right. Beaches, Yeah, a lot of people worship that film. And it's easy to forget, actually. You know, I think it's very easy to go, oh, he was a director of fluffy rom-coms. And certainly Pretty Woman goes that way. But it's easy to forget how dark and kind of gritty is not the right word, but it's certainly... it's interesting for the first hour or so.
Yeah, it's got some tone in it, that film. It's not purely, you know, fluffy.
No, absolutely not. So there we go. What a comedy legend he was. Gary Marshall, who died this week, aged 81. Okay, time now for this week's guests. And I mean guests, because you're getting a clump of two guests, five people in total. Star Trek Beyond comes out this week. And when its cast came to London recently, I jumped at the chance to talk to pretty much all of them. First off, you're going to hear Carl Urban, Bones himself, and John Cho, a.k.a. Sulu, talking about all things Trek and the 50th anniversary, about Urban almost not coming back for this movie, and about Sulu's the sudden revelation that Sulu is now gay. It's a lot of fun. And then after that, you're going to hear Chris Pine, Zachary Quinto, who plays Spock, and Sophia Batella, who plays a new character called Jayla. Now, word of the wise in that one, we were beset by sound problems, so it may be a bit all over the shop, and it's a bit short as well, but we figured you might rather hear at least some of this than none of it. So there you go. Urban, Cho, Quinto, Pine, Patella. Enjoy. Delighted to be joined in the Emperor podcast by Carl Urban and John Cho. How are
Thanks
you, sir?
Thanks for having us.
There. Great to be here.
Congratulations both on the film.
Thank you.
It's a lot of fun. I mean, Carl, you've said in the past, very recently actually, that you almost didn't come back for this one.
That's right, yeah.
John, did you have any thoughts about coming back for this one, or were you both in a way locked in? How did that work for you?
I don't remember. I didn't have the crisis that you did in terms of the material. I didn't have that issue, but I was concerned. You know, when you get it in three films in, you start, you want to make sure your character is taken care of, and you want to feel good about the work that you're going to do, and you want to make sure that you're... I've become Sulu's biggest fan, so I want him to go somewhere interesting, and I want him, and otherwise I don't want to do it. So I can see where you're coming from. It's the point that I'm trying to get to.
For me, the issue was I was not under contract to do another Star Trek film, and I was actually in the process of negotiating to do another film when the Star Trek producers came and said, hey, well, we're doing this, you know, and it's going to be a direct conflict, so you have to choose, it's one or the other.
Right.
And it really wasn't until I talked to Justin Lin and he outlined his vision for not only the film but for the character of McCoy that I thought I'd be remiss to turn down this opportunity. And I realized when I turned up in Vancouver it would have been a horrendous mistake not to be a part of it, just for the opportunity to work with these guys again.
Bones does get a lot to do this time around. Was that as a result of the conversations you had with Justin, or were they already going in that direction?
I think there are already a certain way down the track. You know, obviously there was quite a bit of fan reaction last time that felt that the character of McCoy had been somewhat marginalized comparison to his traditional role and function. And to a certain extent, I agreed with that. And so for me, you know, I was reassured by what Justin had talked about, what he wanted to achieve for the character. But then beyond that, working and collaborating with Simon Pegg was ultimately a very rewarding experience. And, you know, we worked together to, you know, really elevate the material and deliver something that was going to top the first two that we've done.
You get a lot of great scenes with Spock in this one.
Yeah, they were so much fun to play. I mean, we just to have those two characters that are so diametrically opposed to be thrust into a life or death situation and have to overcome their differences in order to survive, we had so much fun.
Is Simon and Doug? I mean, Simon's obviously on set when he's playing Scotty, but is he on set as a writer when he's not in the scenes? Is he there behind the camera making sure, damn it, you stick to the script that I wrote, and if you don't, I will bring out the big stick?
Yeah, there was actually, I would say, you know, and I haven't discussed this in the previous interviews, but there was, you know, sort of a point there where, you know, it's an awkward sort of threshold to cross from having someone who's your friend, but is also the writer, and if you don't necessarily agree with You know, the
yeah, you know, I hadn't thought juncture. About how difficult it is for him. It would yeah. be for him, because normally you get to within this sanctum of the actor's trailer, we get to talk shit, but we can say, oh, they're, you know, like you have the freedom to do that, and we
and he's right
it,
there.
It was just awkward for him, but I can't imagine anybody more equipped to straddle both worlds. He's very intelligent emotionally as well, yeah. and so he can sense. I mean, it's not a situation to me where we would have to go to him, even though we could, because he would sense it. Don't you think? If you were troubled with something, he'd come over and unlike other another writer would be able to go, I can tell you're having an issue with this, and he's that kind of a person.
Is there much room for improv?
Well, there is, and there's a few that are actually made it into the picture, it was just a wonderful collaborative environment, and you know, Simon sent us an early draft of the script that he'd written, said, well, here it is, lads, and you know, if there's, you know, anything that you would like to bring forth in your character, then let me know, and let's work together, and that was really kind of the spirit upon which we all embarked on this journey.
So what did you say to him about Bones, and what did you say to him about Sulu?
You know, I had always wanted to see more of his personal life. It was, you know, the first two were really just him as a professional, and I wanted to see some inner turmoil. And this was not what I thought would happen, but it certainly wasn't answered. That is to say, the stakes in this movie became very personal for him.
Yeah.
But they came to me with the gay family idea very early on. So Simon had thrown that idea out.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, it's an incredible conversation to have these days. I mean, it caused quite a fuss last week. Yeah. At the same time, people are going, it's no big deal. We should have had this conversation 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's the... I think that's, to the filmmaker's credit, that's... I just loved the nonchalant yeah. attitude of the movie. I think that's the triumph of it. Is not just the fact that he's gay, but the fact that it's not anything to... worthy of discussion, you know, in the future.
Absolutely.
So yeah. Hopefully that's indicative of where we're going. This is the first time I'm talking about it, but I did request that the husband be Asian. We ended up having to use Doug, the writer, because we couldn't find an Asian actor in Dubai willing to do that role.
Wow, okay.
But, so it was some trouble. And but the reason I wanted an Asian husband was... The Asian gay male friends I've had, they have always, this is my interpretation, but I've always felt that they have been reluctant to be with other Asian men because of the culture of shame.
Yeah.
And I think other Asian men remind them of their family, so it was difficult to be with other Asian men, and I wanted this to be a little bit of a Valentine to the Asian yeah. gay men that I've known in my life, to say this is a future in which it's nothing.
Yeah.
Just like yeah. a lot of straight people end up with people of their own culture because it's easy and it's normal, that I wanted to present that variation.
And I'm sure so many people have asked you about it, you're probably sick of it, but do you have a reaction to George Takei's reaction to the reaction
to the reaction to the reaction to the reaction to the reaction? Yeah, listen, I had a conversation with George early on, and I understand where he's coming from, and I get it. And however, I just wish, I hope that in the, you know, after he sees the movie and reads perhaps some of the electronic responses,
yeah.
that he's heartened by by how much it means to young people. And, you know, this whole process has made me think again about how important George was in my youth, seeing an Asian person on television when there were zero, really, and how revolutionary that was for me. And hopefully he can, at least if there's anything good for him to glean from it, that there's a lot of gay young people
yeah.
watching this and going, wow, that's cool. That's normal. That's, you know, I think that's important.
It was really great to actually go online and see that response of a generation of young men and women celebrating the fact that they're represented. I think collectively it made us all feel very proud of the fact to be yeah. a part of this.
Absolutely, which is something obviously Star Trek has been right from the very off. It's now in the 50th year. Right from the beginning, it's been about diversity, it's been about acceptance. It takes place in a world where nobody gives a shit, and quite rightly so, about people's sexual orientation or race or color or any of that stuff. Getting involved with this franchise, I mean, obviously late in the day, as you both did, was that an appeal? Was that part of the attraction of this?
Yeah, I think that's one of the enduring appeals about Star Trek, is it presents a hopeful vision of humanity, a vision of humanity that's moved beyond... In the thirst for knowledge and adventure, and you know, on a serious note, it's an ideal. It's a vision of the future that resonates, because it's so far away from where we currently are.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to say that, you know, it's an American television show, and it represents, in certain ways, it represents the best of our species, but to me, it represents a really the best of American thinking.
Mm.
And, you know, like when I came to America, our first home was in Houston, Texas, and we would take relatives out to see NASA because when relatives came to visit, it was a big deal, because it's like, these people did this, now we're here.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
they sent a man to the moon. And there's something to me being in Star Trek that is, you know, culturally important to me to be associated with something, with a part of pop culture that's the best of American offering,
yeah.
you know, the American offering. So
I don't think that it's exclusively American.
I don't. Yeah, I don't.
Mean, to me, it's really about a united globe, you know, and
but
that's
wouldn't
why
you say
you
there's
have,
something
you know you have you know obviously you know you got a Russian and a Vulcan and
yes
black woman, and it's about inclusion and diversity.
So going back to the kind of the idea of 50 years of Star Trek, do you have a favorite version of Trek? And you can't say the one that you're in right now. You have to see. Can you, you know, is it the original series, Next Gen?
Yeah, for me it would probably be the original series. I mean, yep. that's where I first sort of became aware of Star Trek, and you know, I liked it. It was fun. The show had swagger, and as a kid, there were certain episodes that, you know, terrified me, and I, above all, I loved the characters. Mm. You know, I loved the way Kirk, Spock, and Bones interact, and to see how they would have to overcome their personal differences, and I also liked how, you know, the show would quite often engineer little paradigm shifts where you think that the bad guy is this, you know, big evil force, and then you suddenly discover, you know, something about that character that makes you think again. And, you know, I think that's one of the wonderful things about what Simon's done and beyond.
Yeah, yeah.
With Idris's character.
Yeah, absolutely. Although we can talk about that in a spoiler special maybe sometime down the line.
John, with you? The original series is my first, so it's the most special. But I watched The Next Generation in high school, and that was sort of mine.
And Carl, going back to the idea of talking to Simon about what you wanted to do with Bones and put some flesh on the bones, so to speak, I mean, what sort of conversations did you have with him and Doug?
Yeah, well, what was important to me was was many things, but firstly that his relationship with Kirk wasn't inferred, as I felt that it was, and. You know, in this one, you actually get to see him be a real friend, and you understand why it's a valued friendship, that he is really there to help Kirk get in touch with what's going on inside, and in a conciliary kind of a mode, almost a psychologist mode, but most importantly, just a friend. And that was always one of the aspects about McCoy that I was really enjoyed, of that relationship where Kirk could turn to him and say, am I being whatever, and so that was important, and it was an opportunity also to explore the nature of McCoy's heroism. It's not defined by his physical bravery, but it's defined by his courage, his fear, his loyalty, his determination to stand by, you know, his wounded comrade and not abandon him and not, you know, save himself. And you know, I think that those altruistic aspects are what makes the character so special.
What's the situation like for you guys as well? I wonder this a lot with a lot of franchise actors who have different directors come on. So you work with JJ in the first two movies, you know these guys inside out, and in comes Justin Lin. Presumably he has his own ideas, he has his own take on Bones and Sulu and how you guys should play them. What happens then? How does that...
Well, actually, that's the wonderful thing about Justin is he came in and, first of all, was very respectful of our family. Mm. And obviously he is a long-term fan of Trek himself.
Yeah.
And so he was really able to come in and build upon what JJ had... developed, and you know, working together with Simon, I felt like we had a pretty strong brain trust, all heading in the same direction, and that's really important.
Justin's job was tough. I mean, he's charged with, you know, bringing his own thing into it and upholding the original premise of Trek in an honorable way, and also dealing with a bunch of actors who felt like they were invested in it. We're around for two films already. So I thought he did a great juggling job. He was very respectful and yet forceful with his vision, you know, which, if that makes any sense. He came in and he had his ideas, and somehow it worked. I was observing that in some ways it felt like an independent movie because we had started with a different director and a different script, and then that was scrapped, and then we went with... And Justin, but the release date was not going to change. And so there was a sense of, you know, it could have turned into panic, but it turned very inventive. There was like this independent movie kind of spirit to it where Justin was really going with gut instincts that he had. And, and so was Simon and Doug. And
absolutely, absolutely. And guys, I'll let you go now. But
cheers.
Carl, I believe Matt Damon's in this hotel at this very, very moment.
I'm going to hunt on the him floor, down.
I was going to say.
I'm going to get him this time, and I'm just going to kill his girlfriend. I'm going to get him.
You guys have got so much unfinished business. So much unfinished business. Carl, John, pleasure.
Warren, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Cheers, thank you. Delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by Zachary Quinto, Sophia Patella, and Chris Pine. I don't know why I pointed at you, because you know who you are already, but that's just one of the things I do. Welcome all. How are you all?
Very well, thank you.
You're playing Chris and Zachary. You're playing these characters for the third time.
Right.
Do you feel that this time around, more than the other times, you made them your own? Or do you feel that there's still elements of Leonard Nimoy and
I mean, Bill Shatner? Feel like we made them our own the first time.
Yeah.
I mean, that was JJ's mandate, really, when we got these jobs, was to bring our own point of view and perspectives to these characters and honor, of course, the origins and the actors that created them, but to really take them in a new direction. And so I think it was what we worked to do from the beginning. And now I feel like, you know, for me, my connection to this character will always be marked by my relationship with Leonard. And this was the first movie that we made without him. And that was intense. And I feel a real sense of responsibility to him and to the legacy that he created with his character. And so, you know, I was working with that, and luckily the story paralleled that and helped carry me through the experience. But yeah, I mean, I feel for myself like, you know, I have my own distinct relationship with Spock and my own respect and love for him in a way that's informed by Leonard, but entirely unique as well.
Mm. And Chris, the same for you. I mean, there's still... Now and again, little Shatnerisms going in through your performance. How do you modulate that three films in?
At this point, there's no science behind it other than whenever I want to make myself laugh, I'll do it. And
Spock.
I definitely actually this time felt it wasn't that it was easier; it just felt the most comfortable. I guess we've done it. We've now been doing it for a little bit. And, Simon there just felt like a
really like the play there was like the it just felt easier. I mean what am I trying to say is when you have the writer there who's your big brother essentially, who's worked with you writing for you and then throwing you jokes and
it just felt like a completely collaborative team effort, more so probably than any of the other ones. And I've never really felt encumbered by having to live up to what Bill did, but I also really appreciate his kind of his Kirk aesthetic. It's a whole thing, as we know, and
yeah.
And I do like to throw nods here and there to that.
Sophia, as a newcomer to the franchise, is there an initiation ceremony? Is there a hazing? How are you welcomed into the franchise by these two?
I was a bit nervous when I arrived in Vancouver because I know they've been together for two franchises to avoid blinding Zach. And because they've been together for quite a long time, and I was wondering how I was going to get welcomed.
There's a roving microphone going around.
How it was going to fit into that, but I met them on a Monday, and on Friday we were all having fun. And we were
they were very nice.
Huh? We did. We spent a lot of great time together.
We had a great time. Mm. They're lovely people, and I felt home away from home,
mm-hmm.
you know, quite rapidly and for a very long time. And then work was not work. That's what it felt like, genuinely.
Yeah.
The same way that right now, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely. And what about the makeup? I mean, obviously, I imagine it was a few hours for you.
Sapri, I used to think I had it rough, you know. I was like, oh, it's 3 hours and it's really intense, like whatever. And then now, first of all, we have it down to about an hour and 45 minutes. And second of all,
okay.
How long
Sophia,
it used
to be like 3 hours. Now it's like an hour and 50 minutes. Sophia would have to get up at like 1 a.m. We would like still be up hanging out and she'd be like, I have to leave for work.
Yeah.
It was the worst for her. She had like 5 hours of makeup, right?
Yeah, and I didn't realize at first what it meant, because I remember I did my first audition, then my callback, and I signed my contract right before I knew what I was going to do.
Mm.
And then they showed me the photo, and I thought, yeah, great, this is exciting. And I didn't know what it meant.
She was such a trooper, though. I have to say, I mean, I had such a respect for her commitment and her tirelessness and... You know, you really were never, you know, always just like ready to go.
Mm. I mean,
pretty impressive.
Thank you.
I just want to talk about Justin Lin and coming to terms with him as well in this, because obviously you guys worked so closely with JJ on forming these characters.
Right.
And then this director comes in, presumably with new ideas and, you know, how you might play.
I mean, Justin came in with a real, first of all, he came in on an already moving train in a lot of ways. You know, not only have we made two movies before, but there was not a lot of prep time for this film for various reasons. And so Justin came in with a real quiet confidence, I would say. You know, JJ, who is such an extrovert and whose style is so outward. And Justin, who's much more internal, I would say, in his process and... And yet no less confident. You know, he had a very, very clear vision of what he wanted to make and how to make it and how to communicate that to us. He had a lot of respect for all of us and our relationships with one another and our relationships to these characters. And it was a really seamless transition. Of course, we all love and missed JJ, but we were really grateful for Justin's enthusiasm and his history with the franchise. I mean, it meant a lot to him, Star Trek as a kid, and that came through. And I think what he came up with and the film he made is really exceptional. And so that combined with Simon in a more, you know, powerful creative position on this film, I think was a good combination. And the transition was really smooth.
What does Simon do if he's just on set as a writer and you go off script and you improv? What happens then? Does he wield a big stick? Does he yell at you? Does he get physical?
Well, there's not much room to improv in a film like this.
No.
This is not, you know, like a Judd Apatow film.
There's more dialogue scenes, but I guess, in this one than there were.
But what is fun is, you know, you'd pitch an idea, like for instance, in the beginning of the film, I get chased by a bunch of little people, little things, and they're really actually kind of very cute. And then at the end... They come back to the ship with us, and I thought it would be a funny idea to have one of them in an outfit at the end of the film. And so that was a fun little beat that we...
Oh, that's you.
So it's like a little things that... and you'd find that on the day, and you'd pitch it, and then they'd talk to Doug, and Doug'd be into it. So it was a kind of a... It was a jam that way.
No, it's good because presumably that means you can now get a script credit, right?
Yeah, now you can get a what? A script credit?
Yeah, script credit as well.
Chris gets script credit on this movie as well.
Paid twice on this movie. Absolutely.
Well, Simon did, so it's good. It works for some of us.
Precisely.
Yeah, well, thank you, man. Nice to have you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Cheers. Thank you. Okay, so that was all the Star Trek interviews, and now let's start the movie reviews section with Star Trek Beyond.
Star Trek Beyond is... Well, let's go back. Star Trek Into Darkness seems to have become, since it was seen by everyone, become this kind of incredibly reviled, weirdly hated film. I didn't think it was that bad. This is certainly a marked improvement, that said. So people that hate Star Trek Into Darkness, relax. I think you're going to enjoy this one more. I still want to know quite why that film got as much animus as it did. This one is a tighter, more coherent, more emotional, more engaging, more heartfelt Star Trek movie. It's done what I think Batman versus Superman didn't do, which was really, instead of addressing the complaints of the previous film, Man of Steel's sort of urban catastrophe, it kind of added to it. This one has taken some of the criticisms of Into Darkness and actually remedied them. It's gone into space. It's got a lot more of the Star Trekiness back. It's got a lot more of the sort of team camaraderie. It's a film that explores the lovely little kind of chemistry between different characters that we love about Star Trek. So you've got Bones and Spock, who for me are Zachary Quinto and Carl Urban, who are sort of MVPs here. They spend a lot of time together in this movie, and they have great kind of chemistry. You've got Scotty, Simon Pegg, who wrote this one, did a great job.
Co-wrote with
Sophia Boutella's Jayla, this kind of kick-ass alien. So there's lots of little kind of bits of, you know, alchemy taking place on screen, which I really, really liked. The story, it takes them into perhaps less uncharted space, in the sense that you've got this alien with a grudge played by Idris Elba. It's Kral. He's got this gnarled visage, and he's got a grudge against the Federation. He has one line where he says it's time, you know, the frontier pushed back on the Federation. So there's kind of the usual political, you know, imperialist subtext in this, basically this kind of anarchist. And there's kind of a stronger sense of Star Trek geography to this. It's got a bit more of a feel of like them on an alien planet, which we haven't really seen too much of, bar the beginning of the last one, perhaps. Mm. It's definitely an improvement, and I think Chris Pine does a great job as Kirk. I really enjoy the way it opens with ennui, effectively. It's that thing of them just traveling. They've been in space for 3 years, and they're just kind of bored, and he's just a bit over it. And I like that it addressed that.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really nice... I'm assuming quite a lot of Simon Pegg in that whole sequence, but it was confident in itself to say, we're just going to show something that isn't necessarily kinetic and blockbustery. It's just a slightly kind of more measured start, which shows something that we haven't really seen before in this rebooted Star Trek universe. I love that. There's lots of little bits to enjoy. One thing I struggled with a little bit with the direction was I found it a little muddled. I found some of the action choreography and the geography of the action sequences a little confusing, and a bit muddied. I think J.J. Abrams is perhaps... he handles those sequences perhaps slightly better. The camera moves relentlessly and in different angles, and gravity plays quite a big role in this one. So if you think about that sequence in Inception, the corridor fight, there's a lot of things that try and emulate that. But in the end, you're just kind of a bit like... It could be because I sat two rows from the front of the IMAX.
That was a mistake.
I'm going to say that just as a caveat.
I actually thought that Justin Lin, who's the new director in this movie, handled all the action stuff well. And I think a lot of people may have gone into this film slightly concerned that he was going to Fast and Furious Star Trek. And he doesn't at all. As Phil said, there's an emphasis here on talking and on teamwork and on taking Star Trek characters and breaking them up into sometimes unexpected groups. But one of the things I absolutely loved about this movie, and you've mentioned it there, was the grouping of Bones and Spock. Just for me, Kirk, Bones and Spock are the heart of original Trek, certainly. They're the Holy Trinity, as far as I'm concerned. I think they were... Bones in particular was basically a cameo in Star Trek Into Darkness, which, you know, as you heard in the interview there with Carl Urban, is one of the reasons why he thought, maybe I won't come back for this one. But here he's very much up front and centre, gets a lot to do. They're very funny together. They're quite moving together, which is interesting as well. It's, finding new depth and shade in that relationship 13 films in is really interesting. I like
like the fact that it feels like a big old Star Trek episode. To me, it feels like an episode where they get stranded on a planet. But I liked this film a lot.
I did too. I would actually disagree. I'm slightly more with Phil on the action. I think I was generally clear on what they wanted to accomplish from a given action scene, but I wasn't always clear what I was seeing in each shot. So that was kind of slightly annoyed me sometimes. But this is much more of an ensemble piece than either Into Darkness or even 2009 Star Trek. I think there's been a clear effort on the part of the writers to give everyone something to do. Sulu, in particular, gets a much greater role this time, I think. But yes, as you say, Bones as well. The only thing I slightly missed, I love that there was more Bones and Spock and Bones and Kirk. There was a little bit too little Kirk and Spock. I could have done with one or two more scenes there.
Especially given where the plot takes them.
Especially given where the plot takes them, which we won't go into.
Yeah, we will.
Until the spoiler podcast. Yeah. But I think, generally speaking, that stuff was all good. I mean, the bad guy is just a bad guy for the most part. I think Idris Elba gives him a little bit more gravity than the script does, actually. And the thing that he wants to do is MacGuffin 101. Like, it does not matter at all. It could not matter less, quite frankly, what he's after. But if you could just kind of go with that, then it's fine.
Yeah, it's the same for me. His bad guy was the big disappointment of the film for me, because it's such a generic role.
Yeah,
you do not need Idris Elba.
I think you almost do, because there's nothing else to it except Idris Elba.
I don't think he really elevated that much either.
The other thing I like is that it gives it a bit more sense of sci-fi, I think, this one. So they go to a space station called Yorktown. Everything comes back to Hamilton. There's a Battle of Yorktown song in Hamilton. Anyway, they go to a space station, which is a proper sci-fi space station. It could have come straight out of an Ian M. Banks culture novel. It could be nearly a GSV. I don't think it's that big. It's probably an MSV, but it's seriously culture heavy. And that is great to see, like, somebody taking a little bit of a risk in terms of the design of these sci-fi elements. And that was awesome.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, this movie. I think I actually think that some of the characters do get overlooked. I think Uhura gets overlooked an awful lot. I think it almost feels like her subplot got trimmed or cut in some way. But the emphasis for me on the main three, on Kirk, Spock and Bones, Kirk in particular, I think he gets Chris Pine's fantastic in this film. Really good. Really, really good.
Yeah, he's good. I disagree about Uhura. I think she's good.
She barely gets anything to do.
Are you kidding? But she has all those scenes with Krall.
Didn't like them.
Okay.
But there we go.
Four stars.
I reviewed it for Empire. I gave it 4 stars. I think this movie's a lot of fun. I think it is a reaction in many ways to the criticisms of Star Trek Into Darkness, which, again, this, you know, just to make clarify something we said as well on the Star Trek 50th Anniversary podcast, which is, you know, available to listen to now if you want to do that. Star Trek Into Darkness is not a terrible film. It just goes off the rails badly, I would say, in the third act. But there you go. So 4 stars for Star Trek Beyond, A Return to Form. Go see. Next up, Steven Spielberg tackles the BFG. Roald Dahl's the BFG. Helen.
Right, so this is the story of an orphan called Sophie, who's played by Ruby Barnhill, and she is snatched from her bed one night by a giant, who's played by Mark Rylance, and some CG. She basically saw the giant. That's not allowed. So he kidnaps her and takes her back to his country. He is a big, friendly giant. However, his stablemates are not so much. They are much bigger, much less friendly giants. And so the two, Sophie and the BFG, have to sort of team up to, first of all, keep her out of their clutches, and then also, you know, try and stop them from eating people around the world. This is sort of set in a fantasy London, to be perfectly honest. It seems slightly 80s in a few respects late on, but at the same time, sometimes it seems almost kind of Peter Pan-y, turn of the century. Sometimes it seems sort of 1940s blitzy. So it's a really just a kind of a fantastical, the kind of idea you'd have of London if you'd only ever read about it in books, mostly by Francis Hodgson Burnett and people like that. But the BFG himself is a wonderful creation. So he was obviously one of Roald Dahl's greatest characters, I think. And Mark Rylance does him justice and delivers lines which no human being should be able to deliver with a straight face, because the BFG has a very particular vocabulary. The word snozcumbers is about the least of it. Chris, you knew some of those words. What did you have?
Oh, twitchy figglers. He's always talking about his twitchy figglers. And he's got some other things. I can't repeat it in here, what I say about the BFG. I've come up with my own words. But yeah, let's just leave it at that, shall we?
Okay, okay. Probably best. But but the thing is, I mean, you just come out of this wanting to hug the BFG, which I think is the primary thing that you have to get from this film. The BFG has to be intensely lovable, likable character, and he is difficult at times, and he isn't always honest and forthcoming with Sophie about what's going on. But there's so much heart to him that you kind of don't care. And I think that's the big takeaway. There are slow bits in this film. There are bits where it drags a little bit and you're like, I don't care anymore. Let's move on. But you kind of don't care because you're still in it with the character. And fair play to Ruby Barnhill as well. I think actually she was 12 when this was made. And she does a phenomenal, phenomenal job of being not annoying child actor, which I think is you know, all too rare, especially in
especially British. Imagine how it was filmed,
yeah,
you know, with Mark Rylance in a mocap suit and all the craziness and having to react to something that's, how tall is he, and then the other giants are massively taller, yeah, even compared to him. I think this is a lovely film. It's a very warm, family friendly film. I saw it with my two young nephews and they both loved it. They loved all the fart jokes and the Snaz Cumbers and the big giants, and there's this lovely motif throughout where when he's in London he evades detection by assuming shapes around him, lampposts and trees, cars and trees, and he's not a shapeshifter, but he manages to make it look like, as if he's the shape of something. I like little jokes like that. It's a very strange film, and that it has a story, but it's plotless in a weird way. It meanders to a conclusion. Yeah. There's no real sense of peril necessarily. I thought I was really worried for the BFG. I will say that. There's no real sense of peril in terms of Sophie. You don't ever imagine she's going to get eaten by the other bad giants. But I always thought they were just going to start slapping the BFG senseless because there's some really nasty pieces of work in this movie.
Yeah, they really bully him.
Yeah, like, they really do.
Very openly.
Yeah.
And I actually was a little bit worried for Sophie because they added in, or certainly magnified, the sense in the book that he had a sort of a pet child, if you will, in a very non-wrong way before. So sometime in Victorian times, he'd brought another child to his cave, to his sanctuary, and the other giants had found that child. And that sort of gradually becomes clear through the film. I'm sorry, I don't think it's really a spoiler to say that because I think you...
Of course, yeah. I also, but you know, on a practical level, Sophie's, 4 feet tall? And these other giants are about 60 feet tall. And one child to go between seven giants, I mean, that wouldn't sustain them for more. That's a snack.
It's a canapé.
Wow. Yeah. You're right, Chris. So that's the problem with
it. So that's how I equated it in my head. It was like, well, she's not in peril because why would they want to eat her? Because that would be me turning the office upside down to find one finger of Kit Kat, which I have done,
which
in fairness.
Many times.
Many times. And now
so
I'm hungry
I think
again.
Now you see why your analogy doesn't work.
I was wrong. Yeah. I was so wrong.
But this is the last script from Melissa Matheson.
Yes.
And I think it's a very, very strong adaptation in that sense. It's... yes, it meanders particularly in the middle, but she finds the right tone to make it somehow work and to make you not question the things that shouldn't make any sense.
Yeah, and there's some lovely Spielberg visual flourishes as well. There's a wonderful sequence where the BFG takes Sophie dream catching. That's just a lovely sequence. And there's a really funny bit where they have tea with the Queen.
Yes, and so much of that, I love that so much of that was taken straight from the book. So the descriptions of how they build a table for the BFG, straight from the book and straight from Quentin Blake's drawings. And for a child of the 80s, that's really, really exciting.
Absolutely. And Mark Rylance, very, very good.
So gotcha. I just wondered, I haven't seen this film. Two quick questions. Mm-hmm. Which other Steven Spielberg film did it most make you think of?
Weirdly... Hook without the excesses.
Yeah, there was a little bit of Hook in the London scenes, especially. Yeah. I was thinking of Hook quite a bit.
And in terms of another beloved children's story in which a girl gets taken to another parallel place,
sure,
through the Looking Glass, Alice in Wonderland. Where does this one go right? Where that one doesn't?
It's much less weird than that, and I think it's much more focused on character than that was. It's really, it is a character piece for long sections with just Sophie and the BFG talking. Right. And actually, you know, in some ways that's meandering, in some ways that's a great strength of the film, because what you actually want is to learn more about these two very, very lonely characters who don't really fit in anywhere, and they find a sort of a connection with each other, and that's sort of lovely.
I've just thought of a version of this movie where the BFG is played by Larry David. Now I can't get it out of my head.
That would not work, Chris. Stop it.
How amazing would that
Stop
be?
Stop it.
Though? It would be amazing.
Mark Rylance for the win.
He is very, very good. He's a good actor, that Mark Rylance. They should give him a go, more things.
You might be right about that, yeah. Yeah. How close is he to egotting? I think he may be only one letter off.
I don't know.
Maybe two.
I don't know. Does he do the American stuff? Does he go to Broadway?
Yeah, he's been on Broadway recently. Yeah.
Okay, so he just, presumably won. I could look it up, but I find it better to wallow in ignorance. So I'm going to assume that he hasn't won a Grammy.
Yeah, I think it's the Grammy he's missing.
Has he won an Emmy? What would he have been in? Wolf Hall, maybe. Know. Helen's looking it up. This is live Googling. I love it. Okay. David Mark Rylance. What's the other bit? Waters. Is that his name? David Mark Rylance Waters.
Yeah.
Hang on a second. So, his stage name is his two middle names. Oh, my word. We're through the looking glass here, people.
Mind blown.
I'm absolutely... I don't know what to do with that information. That's extraordinary. It's like when you first discover that Tom Cruise's real name is actually Thomas Cruise Mayweather the fourth.
The fourth.
Or the Bradley Pitt is actually William Bradley Pitt.
Wow.
You just don't know. Bruce Willis. Walter Bruce Willis.
Amazing.
Christopher Thomas Ambrose Hewitt.
He was only nominated for an Emmy. He has not yet won an Emmy.
We'll get him there.
But in his defense, he's got Oscar, BAFTAs by the truckful, Olivier's by the truckful, Tony's by the truckful. So he's doing all right. Let's not get
He's got his twitchy figures and all kinds of awards. Lovely stuff. 3 stars then for the BFG. Right. We're going to do something now. We're going to do something a bit different now in this reviews section.
Yeah.
Because we're going to review Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice.
I never had the chance before.
Did you not? No. That's right, you weren't here.
I was on holiday.
Okay, this might take a bit longer than anticipated. because this week, in this country at least, came out a couple of weeks ago in the States, Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, the Ultimate Edition, was released digitally. Digitally on iTunes and various other digital platforms. 30 minutes of additional footage, 3 hours now, Zack Snyder's superhero behemoth. And Helen and I are going to talk about it because my opinion of the movie has changed somewhat and Helen's has not. Seems fair to say.
I thought it was longer. But tell me your view, Chris.
I think it's a better film.
Right.
I don't think it's a perfect film,
no.
And I don't think that the sow's ear has become a silk purse overnight. I really don't think that in any way or shape or form. But I will say this, I think if they'd released this version in cinemas back in March, it wouldn't have attracted half of the brickbats that it did. I think all the talk about removing Zack Snyder from Justice League, which obviously never came to pass, that might never have happened. I think it is a better, more satisfying film that fills in many of the plot holes that the theatrical version have. Little things like Lex Luthor's entire plot are now made clear, which I enjoyed. There is more substance to Clark Kent's apparent out of nowhere hatred of the Batman. You get some scenes of Clark pounding the bat beat in Gotham and walking around and talking to people going, so tell me why this Batman is bad, essentially. You get a little bit more for Lois Lane to do, a little bit more for Amy Adams to do. Not many extended scenes with the bat. All the Bruce Wayne stuff seems to be pretty much intact. As far as I could tell, having seen the theatrical version 3 times, there is only one slight addition to Wonder Woman where she gets mansplained to by some museum dude. And there's an element of that in the theatrical version, but this time he really goes for it in terms of the mansplaining. Mansplaining, in case you don't know, Helen, is when a man explains something to a woman in a patronizing manner.
Thanks, Chris.
You get that?
So helpful.
Okay, I'm thinking manspreading while I'm saying that as well. I'm so sorry. I enjoyed it. I think it, because I don't agree with the initial Empire review, I think it's a 2-star film. That for me now is a 3-star film. I enjoyed this one more. It feels like a more complete experience.
I have to disagree.
You have 90 seconds.
And another thing. I think basically what the Ultimate Edition does is it gives us more of plots that we didn't need in the first place. It adds more complication to backstory that we didn't care about. And genuinely, yeah. I just find it mostly frustrating. Hey, Jimmy Olsen got a line. He got to say his name on screen before they shot him in the head.
They did.
That's great.
They did.
There was a Zack Snyder cameo as the coach of a football team on TV. I don't remember that
in the theatrical cut,
but I think it was him. But anyway,
okay.
That line with the director of the museum talking at length, apparently with no context, like she doesn't even get a word in, I thought was bloody awful.
She still doesn't get named in this one at any point. No point in the movie. You hear the stewardess.
The stewardess says Diana.
Stewardess says Miss Prince, but you don't, she doesn't Diana. Go, I'm Diana, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
There's still some flaws. There's still a lot of flaws. It's still the same movie. So if some of the flaws still apply, the whole Batman Superman thing is built on very, very shaky ground. Their enmity is built on very, very shaky
ground. And who calls his mother Martha? Like, it annoyed me when he called out for, you're killing Martha. Why did you say that name? No reason. There is no reason why he would say that name, because he calls his mother Mom. I just don't... Oh, anyway. And so that annoyed me still. I mean, the fact that we're still getting Bat backstory annoyed me. We don't need it. The way that backstory was portrayed was wrong. Superman is wrong. His parents are wrong. I didn't like. I liked Lawrence Fishburne. I like that you have an editor in a movie. I like that you have an editor of a newspaper in a movie set in the modern age or something like it, worrying about budgets. I think that was great.
Yeah, but then still giving his ace reporter a helicopter out of
nowhere.
I've never
to go across the bay.
I can't even get a taxi receipt paid. What's going on?
I fundamentally don't think you should be allowed to make a Superman movie if you don't like Superman. And I don't think that they like Superman. And I certainly don't think that they get Superman and what he is. Once again, the only time we really see him save anybody in this movie, it's either Lois Lane, which doesn't count, or it's a montage. There are bits that we talked about this. There are bits that I don't hate. I think Ben Affleck is fine. I think Jeremy Irons is fine. Yeah. I don't think it's wrong with their performances. I just think the whole thing is, you know, fundamentally misconceived.
So if you wonder where Helen was back in March, that was the Cliff Notes version of her rant. That you would have ranted had you been on the podcast back in the day. Genuinely, I went into this. I mean, it's a long film. Am I right in thinking it's the only version of the film that now exists? You cannot get the theatrical version?
I watched it on a Czech disc last night. I think you watched the digital...
You watched it on Czech?
I bought it.
The Czech disc did have two discs. It had the theatrical
version. It does, okay. Because I bought the iTunes version, and I'm pretty sure that only had the Ultimate Edition. I'm maybe talking out of my super arse completely, but it's intriguing. I'd love
super,
to...
sorry. We were actually watching it. The flash forward to the future.
Yeah.
This is... I don't think this is a spoiler, actually. I'm going to go say it. The flash forward to the future that Batman has, that vision of the monstrous Superman.
Yep.
And there's a guy hanging next to him with blue bits on his costume. And my sister thought that might be Nightwing. But we couldn't see if he had the world's greatest arse to check it out. Anyway, when you said super arse, it just reminded me of that.
Interesting. I hadn't seen that.
Yeah, but if they introduced the Bat Family and those kind of characters, I think that would actually be really interesting. So fingers crossed for that in the future.
But that's the problem. I'm talking about the flaws that remain in this movie. It still does have about four dream sequences too many. And dream sequences as well, in which major exposition seems to be delivered to people, which is okay. There's still a lot to like about this film. And some of the plot stuff, the Scoop McNary subplot, the Holly Hunter plot is given a little bit more depth. That sequence in the Capitol building is given a little bit more now. Makes a little bit more sense.
They do say that Superman at least helped carry people out of the building before buggering off.
Precisely. It doesn't... Yeah.
I mean, they say it. They don't show it, but...
We do see one person. He does try and save one person. Rather than standing in the flames looking like he's just let off a fart.
Yeah, and then buggering off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So an improvement for me. Again, not a great film. But an improvement. And I think, honestly, I do genuinely believe if they'd released this version, they would have avoided a lot of subsequent problems. But there you go. So, stick with the theatrical release. Star rating for this, 3 stars in it for Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice, - Ultimate Edition. Right, there you go. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We're going to be joined by 2 directing heavyweights. We got Jason Bourne's Paul Greengrass.
Ooh.
Finding Dory's Andrew Stanton.
Ooh.
And his producer, Lindsay Collins.
Lovely.
all very, very exciting indeed. Until then, it's goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye.
It's good to have you back, man.
Thanks so much. It's been really nice to be back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't be a stranger.
I shan't be. Why should I be? I'm here.
Excellent. It's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to reminisce about my adventures yesterday on Insert Name of Film Here with that wonderful actor. Insert Name of Actor Here. See you next week when we'll be talking about Insert Name of Podcast Here.
You can say that bit.
Oh, yeah. Empire Podcast. There we go. That's the one. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Bye.